Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The denuclearization of North Korea and peace on the Korean Peninsula. Broadly speaking, those are the two great goals driving decades of tensions, talks, and failed negotiations between the United States and North Korea. The U.S. has traditionally approached North Korea with a denuclearized first as a condition to pave a path for peace. But could that be changing? As President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un meet in Hanoi for a second historic summit today, could the president be flipping convention on its head yet again and adopting a peace-first, denuclearize-later posture? Just listen to what the president said on Sunday.
I'm not in a rush. I don't want to rush anybody. I just don't want testing. As long as there's no testing, we're happy.
This hour on Point, denuclearization, peace on the Korean Peninsula, and today's historic summit. And you can join us. What do you hope will come out of the summit in Vietnam between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un? Do you see Trump and Kim's relationship as a meaningful step towards peace? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And we will first start today in Hanoi, Vietnam, with Aisha Rasko, NPR White House correspondent. She's traveling with the president. Aisha, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us, you know, what has the mood been like on this day of the summit? What have been the highlights so far?
The president has been really he's been really optimistic today. He met with Vietnamese leaders first early in the morning, Vietnam time. And he basically was laying out Vietnam as a model for North Korea and saying, look, if you agree to denuclearize, this could be you. You could have this thriving economy. And saying that he believes that Kim wants to do this as well. And then this evening, he met with Kim. They had dinner. They had a one-on-one conversation for about 30 minutes. And when they, you know, were talking to the press, they were both saying positive things about each other. You know, Trump called Kim a leader and said that he wants to help North Korea improve economically, and that's what he's going to do. And so President Trump is laying out a very positive outlook right now.
So Aisha, help us understand then the confusion or maybe lack of clarity over sort of what the president's goals are here, because we played that tape from what he said on Sunday about he's not in a rush, that if they just stop testing, that would be good enough for him. But was he also asked today if he has walked back his goals for denuclearization? And if so, how did the president respond?
So he was asked about that, and he said, no, I am still for denuclearization, that he hasn't walked back that goal. But you didn't hear anything else specific about that today. He wasn't, you know, laying out any timelines or even saying to Kim's face, you have to denuclearize, you guys have to do this. It was just kind of very happy talk. And he did mention even tonight, you know, some people say this should be quicker, but we're satisfied with how things are going. And so he's still kind of hedging and not really being willing to set any firm deadlines for North Korea at this point.
Okay. So then what are the goals, if any, that the administration is hoping to achieve from this summit? I mean, we had sort of like a statement of purpose from the meeting last June. What does the president hope to come out of this meeting with Kim Jong-un? Aisha? Looks like we may have lost the line to Aisha Rasko, who's in Hanoi with President Trump. Aisha is NPR's White House correspondent. We'll see if we can get her back. But if not, Aisha, thank you so much for your reporting from Vietnam. Well, let's turn now to two well-versed experts on the U.S.'s entire history with the entirety of the Korean Peninsula. Joining us first is Catherine Moon. She is an expert on U.S.-Korea relations and the politics of East Asia. She's a professor of Asian studies and political political science at Wellesley College and author of Protesting America, Democracy, and the U.S.-Korea Alliance. Catherine Moon, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Magna.
Also with us today from New York is Victor Cha. He is former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, a post he served during the administration of George W. Bush from 2004 to 2007. He's now senior advisor and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor of government and international affairs at Georgetown University. Victor Cha, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hi, Magna.
So let me start by both asking you kind of a basic question. I think a lot of Korea watchers would say that, you know, a wildly successful summit now in Hanoi would lead to, you know, an agreement that Pyongyang would give a full and accurate inventory of its nuclear activities. There would be some process to verify what's actually on the ground there, perhaps even that moving towards a proclamation of end of the Korean War. I mean, there are big goals that we could take steps towards. Kathy Moon, do you think that any of those things are possible in under the current circumstances as the two men meet in Hanoi?
Rhetorically, they're possible, but what the substance behind the rhetoric, potential rhetoric, might be is the big question. And I'm not looking for wildly exciting and new ideas of success that come out of this summit. I think if the two leaders can sustain the conversation, possibly even look toward another round, since obviously these two don't want working-level groups to do the business and they want to be in charge, I think sustaining, maintaining diplomatic relations on a constructive level and slowly working toward some of the difficult areas, such as denuclearization, such as a path toward ending the Korean War, lifting some types of sanctions, especially humanitarian purposes, I think those would be productive. And all those three are on the agenda for this summit. To what extent, to what depth they will get into these issues is a question. Right. And then, of course, the implementation.
Well, Victor Cha, you just in the past couple of days wrote that pigs will fly over Pyongyang before this summit turns out a successful conclusion. Why is that?
Well, yes. If the North Korean leader slapped a piece of paper on the table that had a list of all their nuclear facilities ready for dismantlement, and then Trump slapped a piece of paper on the table that was a peace declaration, then we could call this a success. But I think there's very little likelihood of the first thing happening. We may see some incremental steps by North Korea providing access to some individual sites, most likely sites that they have long since decommissioned and do not need anymore, which can be verified by commercial satellite imagery that they've not worked on these sites for a year or two. You know, they may offer up a couple of these things. And, you know, like Kathy said, if that happens and they allow people to verify it and the process goes on, you know, that's not a bad outcome. I think the one real concern is what the United States is going to pay for a couple of individual sites that no longer matter to the North Koreans. And I think, you know, for President Trump, you know, frankly, this is the ADD summit. I mean, he is in Hanoi physically, but his mind is in Washington because he's going to go from this dinner with the North Korean leader straight to his hotel room and stay up all night and watch the Cohen hearing. So it's going to be, you know, he's not going to be fully focused on this summit as much as one would like, and may be desirous of a quick foreign policy success and may give up too much for what would be small steps by North Korea.
I'm glad Victor has added a little bit of dark humor to this conversation. That's a very serious one going on in Hanoi. And I agree with him completely. But I would also add here that the Trump administration has been very actively toning down the expectations prior to this summit. And, you know, including the so-called hawkish John Bolton, the national security advisor, but more importantly, the special representative for North Korea, Mr. Steve Biegun. He has been mapping out through public speeches a sense of a prolonged diplomatic engagement and less of an urgency in terms of immediate achievements on denuclearization, which reflects, I think, reality. Denuclearization can take a very long time if we want to do it right, thoroughly, and with the inventory that Victor mentions. There's one thing here when you started off asking about what's success,
right?
Success for Mr. Trump is really his making progress toward a Nobel Prize. I mean, I look at success for Trump personally, what he would consider success versus what's success for the U.S. government and for our allies in East Asia and peace in the region, two different things.
Mm. Well, so you mentioned Steve Biegun. He is the State Department's top North Korea envoy and the series of speeches that he's been given. We have an excerpt from one of them here. This is when Biegun was at Stanford University just last month, and he did call for North Korea to turn over a complete list of its nuclear weapons, its production facilities, and missiles. But then he said this as well.
Before the process of denuclearization can be final, we must also have a complete understanding of the full extent of the North Korean weapons of mass destruction and missile programs. We will get that at some point through a comprehensive declaration.
That's the U.S.'s top North Korea envoy, Stephen Biegun, at Stanford University last month. Victor Cha, let me just ask you something about whether we're at the beginning or in the middle or the end of a process here. Because Could it not be seen that the president really did kind of do a reset in terms of the U.S.'s approach to negotiating with North Korea, with these face-to-face summits between him and Kim? And let's grant him that. And because that may be the case, this is only their second meeting. So is it unrealistic for us to expect any sort of major agreement or pronouncement? And that, in fact, the administration toning down its expectations is the right thing to do if we're at the beginning of a new process?
Well, yeah, it's a total reset. I mean, we started out in 2017 literally on the warpath, talking about fire and fury, moving military assets to the region, then moving to a diplomatic process with summit meetings between these two leaders without much preparation before those meetings. And so they led to statements with not a lot of substance behind it. So we are completely at the beginning of this process right now, and we have a long way to go.
All right. Well, Victor Cha and Kathy Moon, stand by here for just a second. We'll take a quick break and we'll come right back. We're talking about today's historic summit, the second summit between President Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. This one taking place in Hanoi, Vietnam. An interesting story there, just the location of the summit. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about today's historic summit, the second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, taking place in Hanoi, Vietnam today. I'm joined by Kathy Moon. She's an expert on U.S.-Korea relations, a professor of Asian studies at Wellesley College, and author of Protesting America, Democracy, and the U.S.-Korea Alliance. Victor Cha joins us as well. He's former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council during the administration of President George W. Bush. He's now senior advisor and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Kathy Moon, before the break, I had asked Victor Cha about whether or not the president deserves the benefit of the doubt for resetting the U.S.'s approach to North Korea, and so that we ought to be looking at the negotiations at a beginning versus rather a middle or an end. And Professor Cha basically said, yeah, like there has been a reset. What's your take on that?
There has been a reset from a Republican Party perspective. But I think we need to have a longer sense of history about the bilateral relationship and what might have been possible earlier than now in terms of diplomatic engagement. So Trump, yes, has made it okay for any Republican in the future, as long as the North Koreans don't slap him in the face and embarrass the United States completely in the future, to bring up engagement, diplomatic engagement, as a serious policy option that is going to continue on the table. However, in truth, we had so much more substantive engagement diplomatically, with even getting close to setting up liaison offices in Pyongyang when Bill Clinton was in office and Madeleine Albright as the Secretary of State. We got very close to possibly sealing the deal on denuclearizing North Korea when the North Koreans had so much less nuclear capability. And so I see it differently, that we have lost over 20 years of time and allowed the North Koreans to build up and become as formidable as they have, so that talk about fire and fury could happen. Did it need to go that direction? In hindsight, no.
But can I just jump in here? I mean, when you say we've lost 20 years of time, that's not due to President Donald Trump,
no,
though.
I mean,
we're talking of 8 years of the Obama administration and their, I don't know, could we call it passivity with their strategic patience?
My comment is that we have been here before. We have been here on the edge of diplomatic progress over 20 years ago. And so if we look at it in that light, this is not so brand new as a reset. Diplomatic engagement itself was tried, and we had gotten much further 20 years ago than we have now.
I see. Victor Cha, just want to give you a quick chance to respond to that.
So if we're going to rehash the history, I was part of a negotiation for over 4 years with the North Koreans as part of the U.S. delegation. Well, we logged many, many hours trying to get the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons program, enacting a freeze, being able to disable parts of their nuclear reactor, getting inspectors in. But where it all fell apart was it came time for North Korea to give their declaration of all of their capabilities, their scientists, their fissile material, their plutonium program, their uranium program, all of these things. We started out with site visits, which is what's probably going to happen as a result of this Hanoi summit. And then we moved to the stage where they were supposed to give their declaration. And they never gave it. You know, they don't want to show what they have. And so I can understand why the Trump administration is lowering the bar on the notion of a declaration right up front, because the North Koreans are not willing to give it. And we're, again, receding back to looking at individual sites rather than looking at the whole denuclearization process as a whole process. I think what is different this time, of course, is that the president himself has invested in the diplomacy personally. President Trump has put a lot of capital into this issue. I mean, he is out there every day defending the North Korean leader's intentions. Like, one of the things we'll find from Hanoi is that the North Korean leader will actually speak for himself, and his intentions won't be filtered through either the United States or South Korea, who've basically been the spokespeople for the North Korean leader.
I know you want to respond, Kathy.
Oh, I think he made a really good point, Victor, that, you know, we haven't heard Mr. Kim's voice. And so that's what we'll be looking for. The last time we heard his voice was when he addressed his own public on January 1st of this year in the annual New Year's address. And that was an interesting text to read and to hear, because it was very explicit that for him and his country, denuclearization does not mean what the U.S. had expected,
right,
of give it all up, right? And that they expect in turn a denuclearization on the part of the U.S. government in East Asia, which, I mean, that would be a no-go. So I think these are really important historical things to keep in mind. I would just add to Victor's comments about, even if the North Koreans were to give up certain nuclear facilities in terms of allowing inspectors in, et cetera, The reality is the North Koreans have at least 20 ballistic missile testing sites, manufacturing sites, at least. So one or two that's already partly decommissioned or fully decommissioned, you know, that's really not going to make or break the reality of nuclear power.
So, Kathy Moon, I'm really glad you brought this up because, in fact, just yesterday, Victor Cha, you were sitting before a House subcommittee on foreign affairs giving testimony about what might happen or what the U.S. might like to see happen today in Hanoi. And I watched that testimony. It was really interesting because Kathy, Victor brought up this exact same number that you did about that there are 20, currently at least 20 undisclosed missile sites in North Korea. And Victor Cha, you said yesterday to the congressmen and women that North Korea could close some of those facilities, but they will never fully denuclearize because they have ones that they no longer need, but they'll hold on to what they already have, right? And then you already, you said also, you brought up some other, four other interesting numbers. And I want people to hear about these. So you mentioned 1963, the year where, I guess, ground was first broken around one of the North Korea's main nuclear facilities. And then you also mentioned another number, 108. That's the number of times President Trump has made reference to whether or not we need to have U.S. forces in Korea. Why did you want the congressmen and women to know about that number?
Well, first, thanks for watching the testimony. Secondly, for the number 20, you know, these are sites that CSIS through satellite imagery has identified as undisclosed North Korean short, medium, and intermediate range ballistic missile bases. And why those are important is North Korea has a strategy of negotiating their past, which are essentially to offer up for inspection things they don't need. And they're willing to negotiate their future in terms of the promise not to transfer weapons or maybe the promise not to produce more weapons. But they're not going to negotiate their present, which are things like these 20 missile bases, the 20 to 60 nuclear weapons that they have probably on the higher end, uranium enrichment facilities, scientists, these sorts of things. So that is what they're trying to keep away from the negotiating table while they ask for a lot from the United States. The number 108 refers to the number of times that President Trump, either publicly on social media or elsewhere, has referred to what he sees as the lack of a need for U.S. troops in South Korea, the 28,500 troops in South Korea. There's a consistent message going back for three decades, which is these troops are expensive. The South Koreans can defend themselves. Why are we defending them? We should bring them home. The first time he said this was long before he became president in 1990, actually in a Playboy magazine interview. So he is held deeply to this particular view. And I think the whole question of a peace declaration, if it comes out of this meeting, you know, a day from now, if there's a peace declaration and there's no longer a state of hostilities on the peninsula, I think the next logical step for the president is he's going to start raising this question of whether we need forces on the Korean Peninsula anymore.
So, Kathy Moon, let me hear you on this, because I know you've also written about South Korea's view and maybe desires for this moment as well, because you've written how while we've had these two summits between Trump and Kim, there has been a lot of activity between Kim and President Moon in South Korea, like enthusiastic diplomatic activity. In fact, I think Kim Jong-un is going to visit Seoul later this year, almost unimaginable until very recently. I mean, could South Korea's enthusiasm to move forward with North Korea, could that have an effect, perhaps, I don't want to say undermine, but could it have an effect on the negotiations between Trump and Kim now?
Well, I think there is a certain dynamic at work that the inter-Korean relations, the diplomatic engagement between the North and the South, that is way ahead of the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and the DPRK. The North-South relationship has been, in some ways, guiding, if not pushing or prodding, the U.S. North Korea relationship. As Victor said, the South Koreans have become an unofficial spokespeople for the DPRK government. But by the same token, if things go well in this round in Hanoi, then that will give more momentum for the inter-Korean relationship. So they're not separate for sure. But I think that the Singapore summit actually legitimized a very, very aggressive inter-Korean relational dynamic. Aggressive in the sense of being engaged, intensifying their engagement, and coming up with grandiose ideas, whether it's reopening past projects, joint projects, or starting new ones. But right now, those things are relatively on hold because of the issue of denuclearization. South Koreans have what I call drunk the inter-Korean relations improvement Kool-Aid for now. But South Korean public opinion is also not a stable one. They can change at any time. So lately, in the last 6 months, they are more for unification and for improved relations. But people are also very skeptical about things going too fast. So I don't think the South Koreans will lose their heads over this. But there is some concern that the South Korean government might be pushing this a little bit faster than is practically reasonable.
Okay, so Victor Cha, jump in here. I mean, given what Kathy Moon just said, I'm thinking back to what you were saying a minute or two ago that, you know, is there the possibility that the president or the Trump administration more broadly may head down a path to undermine the very reason by which or for which we have, what, 28,000 troops on the Korean Peninsula? Is that a concern?
Yeah, I think it's a concern. I think for the South Korean government, this progressive South Korean government, they don't really believe that that can happen. One, because they believe the United States sees it as in its interests to keep forces in Korea. And two, they think that the U.S. Congress can stop the president, an impulsive president, from making this decision. But the history of this is the United States, in terms of its forces on the peninsula, has made changes in the past on at least three or four separate occasions. And in each case, we did it unilaterally. We didn't consult with the allies because there are troops. So I think this is kind of a blind spot, frankly, for a South Korean government that is, as Kathy said, really headstrong on moving forward on engagement, wanting to reopen some of the inter-Korean economic cooperation projects like the joint industrial project at Kaesong or the tourism project at Kumgang Mountain. They really want to push forward with these things and hope that a lifting of sanctions or partial lifting of sanctions after Hanoi will also apply to those sorts of activities. But it's a real blind spot for them, I think. And again, we just don't know. I mean, the president has said on numerous occasions that, no, we're not going to touch forces this time. But nobody expected him to offer up a cessation of U.S. ROK military exercises in Singapore last time. I mean, his defense secretary didn't even know he was going to do that. So we just don't know what's going to happen, especially since the president's going to be going into this meeting sleep-deprived, you know, angry about the Cohen hearings and wanting a big foreign policy success. And Steve Biegun, who I love him, I think he's great, I worked with him on the NSC, is trying his darndest to make progress, but it will be incremental because the North Koreans are not going to concede anything big to the working level. They're going to do it at the highest level. And President Trump doesn't like small ball, so he may say, all right, let's try to get a bigger deal. I'll put other things on the table if you will, too. So it's really unpredictable.
But I think in terms of these dynamics, ultimately Congress will become a player. That if Trump goes too far and says things and promises things that don't represent U.S. national interests, he will get pushback in Washington.
Well, and in fact, regardless of, almost anything that the president might agree to coming out of a summit like this, Congress would have to have input.
Yes, absolutely. Whether it's funding to assist with economic development, you know, the great promise that Trump seems to promise North Korea in terms of economic development, whether it's changing the armistice into something of a permanent peace treaty, all of these things require congressional support and endorsement. But the problem with the U.S. Congress is, and it's reflective of the American public, we really don't know much about North Korea, period. The only words that seem to pop up in relation to North Korea, as far as members of Congress are concerned on a daily level, is nuclear weapons, dictator, human rights. But in terms of knowing or even caring about the economic potential and the economic deprivations currently, And also, I do believe that Kim Jong-un is serious about reconstructing the economy. The North Koreans don't use the word economic reform, but they say development. I do think he is truly serious about economic development, mostly because his own tenure, his own own continuation on the throne really depends on that. But even if we wanted to support that process of an opening of some sort, eventually Congress would have to be part of the equation, and we're not there.
Right. So, Victor Cho, just got a minute before we have to take a quick break here. Your thoughts on what Kathy Moon's saying about Congress's ability Congress's current level of knowledge about how to best deal with North Korea?
I mean, I think there are people in Congress and on the staff who actually know the issue quite well. I mean, there are two things here. The first is oversight. And Congress has asked the administration for briefings open and closed door on what their strategy is to North Korea. They get no response. The second is that they have passed some legislation, some amendments to try to condition the president's efforts to do anything with forces on the peninsula. But it's not clear, like, if the president actually acts on it, whether Congress can stop them. It would actually create a constitutional crisis. And the third, of course, is human rights, which I hope we can talk about after the break, because Congress has been adamant on that, and it's actually very important to a successful outcome in this summit.
We absolutely will, because it's closely tied to any kind of economic development that could potentially happen in North Korea. So Victor Cha and Kathy Moon, stand by. We are talking about today's second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, taking place in Hanoi, Vietnam. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the summit in Hanoi, Vietnam, between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. I'm joined today by Catherine Moon and Victor Cha. And let's go briefly to the phones. Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Frank, you're on the air.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for taking my call. Just two quick questions for your guests. One, do you support the president in this endeavor, and do you wish him success? And number two, what would success be considered on the part of, in the minds of other stakeholders in the region, specifically China and Japan?
Right, Frank, great question. So thank you so much for your call. Kathy Moon, let me just start with you. Do you support the president in his endeavors right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a very good thing that we have embarked upon this face-to-face set of meetings between the two leaders, because that is the way that it hasn't worked before. Let's put it that way. Without the two heads of state meeting, we haven't made much progress. So why not try this? And President Trump has been quite committed to this, and it seems like Kim Jong-un is committed. So, yes. What would success look like in the eyes of China and Japan? They would look very different. Success would look very different. For the Chinese, they're happy to see this process go on. And they would be glad to have the a peace agreement and also a denuclearized, if not a North Korea that is embarking on denuclearization, because they also are uncomfortable with North Korea's nuclear tactics. But the Chinese would like to have some input into that process. The Japanese, I think, are sitting there right now watching this process unfold with, shaking in the knees and holding their breath because of something that Victor had mentioned before. If this kind of diplomatic engagement and so-called progress leads to a serious questioning of the presence of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula, then that affects Japan's security position as well. The Japanese force, the U.S. forces in Japan and the U.S. forces in South Korea are linked as part of a U.S. regional military presence, sphere of influence. The nuclear umbrella that the U.S. has extended over Japan and South Korea, that would be up for questioning. So I think for the Japanese, Mr. Trump getting too close with Mr. Kim too fast makes them nervous. Mm.
So, Victor Cha, let me turn back to you because there's another big part of this story that we all want to discuss, and that's this question of human rights in North Korea and how if the United States doesn't really sort of maintain a laser-like focus on that, it may actually impinge on any kind of agreement or progress coming out of this summit here. And first of all, Victor, I just wanted to play a little bit of tape here. This is President Trump talking about how Vietnam has made great economic strides in the past several decades. And of course, the summit's going on in Hanoi. The president sees Vietnam as a symbol of economic growth after the Vietnam War, of course. And the president was addressing the Vietnamese prime minister earlier today. And he was saying that he hopes that Kim Jong-un sees Vietnam as a model.
If you look at what you've done in a short time, he can do it in a very, very rapid time, make North Korea into a great economic power.
So that's President Donald Trump in Hanoi. But Victor Cha, you've been saying for quite some time now that no real economic advancement or investment in North Korea can happen for as long as there isn't an improvement in the human rights situation there. So tell us more about that. Why is that such a central part of this puzzle that President Donald Trump may not be paying enough attention to?
Well, he's definitely not paying enough attention to it. I mean, in the first State of the Union speech, he brought North Korean defectors, the family of Otto Warmbier, the student who was killed in North Korea, to the chamber and featured them in the State of the Union speech. You know, ever since he's met Kim, he doesn't talk about human rights at all, which I understand in the sense that, you know, having been part of the negotiations, when you finally get diplomatic traction with North Korea and somebody raises human rights, you're like, no, the priority is denuclearization. We can't talk about human rights. It's inconvenient. It'll offend them, so on and so forth. But the reality is that if we want the core deal that Trump is offering is we can make you rich if you denuclearize, neither of those things can happen unless North Korea opens their society, addresses human rights in some fashion. And let me explain why. First, on denuclearization, we cannot get verifiable denuclearization in North Korea given the way the society is today. We can't go and visit sites whenever we want to. I mean, this was even a problem in verifying in the Iran JCPOA, and Iran is a much more open society than North Korea. So in terms of verifiable denuclearization, right, Trump's goal, human rights matters. There has to be a more open society. And then second, in terms of the economic incentives, sure, presidents can say, you know, U.S. companies, you should now go into North Korea. But given U.S. law today, the general counsel of any American corporation is not going to advise putting money into North Korea if there are violations of human rights along the supply chain, which there are. So these things are not just inconvenient facts. They are integral to achieving either of the two objectives, denuclearization or making North Korea economically better off.
Right. And so just to be clear, I mean, in the law that one of the – at least one of the laws you're referring to is this 2017 legislation on sanctions that prohibits imports of anything produced or manufactured by a North Korean citizen, right? And so to the point that you're making is no company is going to be investing there if immediately they're in violation of U.S. and perhaps even international law. Kathy Moon, another point here is that we have gone, what, a couple of years now without the administration having a senior envoy for human rights or human rights abuses, I should say, in North Korea. And that's something that legislatively the administration is supposed to have.
Right. Based on 2004, 2008 and numerous reauthorizations of the 2008 North Korean Human Rights Act. I have my comment on that is, you know, there are so many positions in the Trump administration that have yet to be filled. So not filling a human rights envoy on North Korea is not an exception. However, it sent a pretty clear message to those who care about human rights, both in the United States, internationally, and in North Korea, when the Trump administration basically decommissioned that position. And now there's talk about appointing one, but it's a little bit late. We've lost time in tracking issues, and also it just didn't end up on the Trump administration's general agenda. Sure. So, you know, better late is late is better than never, but we'd have lost some momentum there. I think on North Korean human rights, I have a slightly different take, which is that there is no monolithic North Korean human rights violation. It is not just about prison labor. It's not just about the detention centers, about the gulags. There are also human rights that affect women's rights, children's rights, disability rights. And I do give some recognition to the North Korean state when they are interested in engaging on some of these issues. So if you look at some of the UN Human Rights Commission's work, there are times when North Koreans are asking, the diplomats are asking genuine questions about how do you improve children's education, children's health, et cetera. Now, the most human rights activists don't put those issues at the top of the human rights, you know, hierarchy of issues. But I think there are what I call backdoor channels, underground channels, side door channels that we can use to work on human rights without knocking down the front door of the North Korean state and naming and shaming them constantly to make them so defensive. They got so defensive when in 2014 there was a big report on the North Korean human rights violations. They really went ballistic.
But shouldn't they have been? I mean, when we're talking about forced labor, mass starvation, I mean, they should be defensive because these are out-and-out violations in the eyes of the global community.
Absolutely. So documenting and publicizing is great, but should it be part of a diplomatic dialogue at Hanoi? I say right now, no. For the practical reasons that if we're going to be focusing on denuclearization and potential road to peace, they need to stay focused on that.
Okay. Victor Cha, I'm going to come back to you in just a second for your response to that. But Kathy Moon, I mean, Victor a minute ago was saying, well, hang on, though. If the president of the United States is saying one of the carrots that that he has to offer Kim Jong-un is the prospect of, you know, economic growth, you know, becoming the next Vietnam, but that is practically impossible given the laws of the United States of America, let alone international agreements, doesn't the president have to come to terms with that?
Yes, except that the reality also is that no matter what Trump says, Kim Jong-un is not going to open up his gulags. They may be able to work on other aspects of, quote, labor rights, but he's not going to open up his gulag. So let's try to focus on continuing the pressure on that level of the naming and shaming when necessary, but also when it comes to actual diplomacy by two heads of state, they're not going to get down to the nitty-gritty. I hope that President Trump will make some statement or gesture toward Kim about the need to work on human rights improvements in North Korea. Most likely, Kim will say, duly noted, let's go on. So, but I don't see anything really tangible coming out of this or even in the immediate aftermath.
Victor Cha?
So I have one specific recommendation, right? So I understand everything Kathy's saying, but I have one specific recommendation in terms of how they should handle it in the negotiations, and that is, if there is some partial sanctions lifting, as we talked about earlier in the hour, it would probably involve South Korea and North Korea reopening the Kaesong Industrial Complex. This is the joint industrial complex of South Korean management and North Korean labor. So the one human rights thing they could do there is pay the workers. Pay the workers. Right? When this was open in the past, the South Korean companies and managers could not pay the workers directly. They had to pay essentially the North Korean government. And what the North Korean workers got instead was three square meals in the factory cafeteria. So just pay the workers. That would be the simplest thing, and that would be a nod to at least labor rights, if not human rights.
There's another thing that the North Koreans could do, which would don't have to be part of this summit. North Korean labor is sent abroad to earn foreign currency for the regime. And that is another situation of labor rights violation where people are paid, you know, pennies of, and the brokers as well as the government agencies that are sponsoring them are the ones reaping the benefits. But that also requires U.S. diplomacy toward the host societies, Russia, for example, China, and many other countries that actually buy North Korean labor. It's been decreased since the heightening of U.S. and U.N. sanctions, but North Korean labor is going to be up for grabs both to South Korea and internationally as cheap labor if there is some kind of an opening. And that's where the emphasis can't be only on Pyongyang. It also has to be on Moscow, China, or any other country that wants to buy North Korean labor as cheap, potentially exploited labor.
Yeah. Well, Victor Cha and Kathy Moon, we've just got a couple minutes left to go here. And Victor, I wanted to ask you a question. Do you see, I mean, a lot of the president's critics would say this, but do you see an inconsistency in the way the president is approaching talks with North Korea versus when he tore up the Iran nuclear deal here? I mean, many people would say that the objections that the president had to the Iran nuclear deal ought to hold with North Korea as well, too, because, I mean, for example, North Korea is still a major arms dealer, even to places in the Middle East. So is there an inconsistency here?
There's a rather large one, I would say. You asked earlier what would be a successful outcome of the summit. You know, if we could get a document that looked like the JCPOA, a 150-page detailed document with 300 pages of annexes negotiated at a highly technical level, I think everybody would consider that a real success in this negotiation with North Korea. Instead, what we got at Singapore was a four-paragraph statement, you know, which really didn't take us very far. And then while we are still at the beginning of this process, we have to remember that these are the leaders who are meeting now. We are testing the hypothesis and the criticism that had been made in all the past three decades of negotiation of working stiffs like me who were trying to negotiate this when they said, you got to have the leaders talk to each other because there's only one person in North Korea who makes a decision, and that's the dictator.
Right.
So we are really testing this right now. And while we are at the beginning of it, their expectations are quite high because the leaders are meeting now. So they should be able to make progress that the working level people cannot. And so if we come out of Hanoi and the progress that we see is really not much more than somebody like a Steve Biegun or, you know, on the North Korean side, Kim Hyuk-chul, if it's not much more than what they have been able to achieve, then we really have to ask ourselves, are we really making progress here?
Kathy, last thought?
Yeah. I think something we have not addressed and that many people leave out of analysis regarding USDPRK relations is that North Korea, even though Kim Jong-un is a dictator, he still works as part of an elite cohort. And he still has domestic pressures that he has to deal with and address. And he no longer can just shoot soldiers or generals that disagree with him or potentially challenge him. But as this diplomatic engagement with Trump has begun, there is also the issue of the North Korean military being on edge about what their future role is as one of the major institutions so-called safeguarding that society and getting a lot of benefits in that society. And so I think we need to pay attention to some of the domestic impact that will come out of such meetings, as in Hanoi.
Wow. Well, so domestic impact, and then as Victor said, again, we have the two leaders meeting as well, so testing a theory that's been held for decades. Kathy Moon, professor of Asian Studies and Political Science at Wellesley College and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for East Asia Policy. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And Victor Cha, former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council during the administration of George W. Bush, and senior advisor to and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and a professor of government and international affairs at Georgetown University. Victor Cha, it's been a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magda.
I'm Magda Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.